The following is for information purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. All opinions and views expressed by the contributors to this podcast are in a personal capacity only. They do not represent the views of Progressive Equity Research or any other organization mentioned in this podcast. In today's episode, private investor and host of the Desert Island Investor podcast, Mark Atkinson, rejoins me for a conversation with MPAC CEO Adam Holland. Mark's professional background was in the paper and packaging industry. He has been a shareholder in MPAC since 2013, when it was known as Molins. Adam has enjoyed a varied engineering career, initially working in space technology, then with Rolls-Royce and for JCB, before joining MPAC initially as COO in 2021. He has a track record of solving engineering problems in global industries and leading teams that provide after-sales care for large multinational customers. Adam gives us a detailed run-through of the rich legacy of the business he now runs and its evolution into a modern automation systems provider to the global packaging industry. He talks about the scale of MPAC's market, the challenges and opportunities to grow with existing and new customers, both organically and via infill acquisition. We learn from Adam why he prefers to reinvest in the business than to pay dividends today, how MPAC has significant potential in the gigafactory market for the scale production of modern batteries, and that scaling the business and maintaining its culture of engineering excellence and customer service is vital in his vision to make MPAC into a business capable of being 10 times its current size. Please enjoy our conversation with Adam Holland.
Brought to you by Progressive Equity.
Okay. Hi, Adam. Can we start by learning about you, your background, and your journey to being the CEO of MPAC?
So I'm a Cambridge University physicist. That's where I started. And my first job was pretty cool. Like, I got the chance to join a business in Oxford, actually, working on satellite power systems. You know, really, really interesting first role. And I got the chance to work on the first spacecraft that were powered by lithium-ion batteries. You know, lithium-ion is very much the topic of today with electric vehicles and the uptake across the world of battery energy storage systems and so on. Well, I was working on the first spacecraft to be powered by lithium-ion batteries, you know, straight out of university, working for a chap called Rob Spurrett, who went on to go to and be chief exec of Lacuna Space. I left the satellite world and moved into aerospace with Rolls-Royce in Derby, working for Andrew Heath. Really interesting period working on the kind of first applications of telemetry for Rolls-Royce onto Boeing and Airbus aircraft. And then I went on to work for a really interesting chap called Mark McDonald. He's now chief exec of Thrasher Aircraft. But at that point in his career, he was running another bit of Rolls-Royce, the energy sector for Rolls-Royce, and I went to work for Mark in Montreal in Canada, building gas turbines for the oil and gas and power generation industries. That whole sector was then divested to Siemens. That was a really interesting process, and I ended up working for Siemens for a couple of years before joining JCB to run the spare parts business for JCB. You know, in its essence, it's providing oil and filters and spare parts for diggers, excavators, those kinds of equipment. But you know, if you think about it as being supplying parts for every machine that JCB's ever built anywhere on the planet, that it becomes quite an interesting logistics challenge and a real customer service challenge. And that was a fascinating business to run for a short period of JCB before moving into their power business on diesel generators and battery power packs, and then briefly involved with their heavy products, sort of large excavator business before joining MPAC in 2022. So I think it's a really varied career. I've run lots of different businesses and in essence knew nothing about any of them when I started. I worked in the space industry, construction, aerospace, oil and gas, and now where I am in automation. So, you know, is there any common theme to the things that I've done? Well, if there is one, it's this. They've all been engineering and technology businesses of some sort. They've all produced a product and supported that product in service through its life. And they've all been, in their very essence, global businesses that, that bring you into contact with, you know, every country on the planet. So it's been a really interesting period for me, and here I am in MPAC today.
So they're all engineering-led businesses, and you've joined an engineering-led business. But just your last stop at JCB, I think most of us probably get a reference on the other companies that you mentioned. I think most people will be aware of JCB as a UK manufacturing and engineering success story. But as a privately owned family business, not that well understood. Can you just give us a little bit more there? What were the main learnings you take with you from JCB into MPAC today?
I think probably when people think about JCB, the first image that comes to mind after the kind of classic image of a backhoe would be Lord Bamford. And
yes.
And I think that's probably the most important, you know, thing I should say about my experience there, was that he really did provide very, very visible leadership, not just outside the company and the way he engages with the outside world, but within the organization as well, and made a really big impact on everyone that I worked with and me. One of the things that echoes through the whole organization is this incredible sense of urgency to get things done. And, you know, Lord Bamford will talk about his father starting the business and the sense of urgency that he brought to the organization. That echoes for me in the way I lead my life today. So, and I think it's probably important to say the sense of urgency doesn't mean rushing around getting lots of things done very quickly. I define a sense of urgency as being doing something important every single day. You know, that's a real sense of urgency. And that echoes from everything that JCB stands for. I think the other thing I'd say is it was a very good organization for creating opportunities for people to come up through and experience some incredible roles. And I was lucky enough, you know, working for Ian Sayers, Ian took a chance on me and put me into some great roles in my time at JCB, and you know, he supported and challenged me, and I learned an enormous amount from that process, and that organization does that very well, and I think that's something that I brought forward into the MPAC world as well. So creating opportunities for people is essential.
Okay, we want to come and talk about the future, but you are unfortunately joined today by two stock market dinosaurs who remember MPAC as Molins and a very successful UK company with a rich history. I think Mark might even remember when it made products for rolling cigars in Cuba in the late 1800s. I'm not sure. Did you come across Molins in your professional life, Mark?
Yeah, very generous of you that, Jeremy. But I'm from the paper industry originally. I worked for a company, we didn't produce cigarette paper, but we did produce a product called Astrolux, which is a high gloss coated board, and that was made into the cigarette packets. And I do remember orders going through the system for John Player Special. So that's the only link that I've got. Adam, I just wondered if you could touch on, as Jeremy's alluded to, the company's origins and its rich history.
Yeah, I'm very happy to. I mean, it is an incredible organization. It's been around for over 100 years. And as you say, it started manufacturing equipment for making cigars and then evolved into one of the largest companies in the world making machinery for producing cigarettes. You know, one stage, Molins employed 3,000 people. You know, it had $500 million in revenue, and manufacturing sites in the UK, of course, but also in the US, Czech Republic, and across Asia. So, I mean, an incredible organization and, you know, real success story. But you know, roll forward to the sort of mid-teens, you know, 2015, 2016, you know, cigarette usage was in decline at that point. The Molins business had largely become an aftermarket business, really. It was still producing two or three new machines a year, but perhaps 80% of its revenue came from services at that point. And by 2015, 2016, you know, it was heading rapidly into the red and actually had a year of loss-making. So a real period of decline over many years. And I think the leadership team, you know, there were some significant changes at that point in Molins' history to evolve into the MPAC business that we are today. And you know, it's important to say we're no longer trading as Molins. We rebranded and relaunched ourselves in that period.
It often takes a long time for a company to shed its past reputation. Now, MPAC might not be considered a tobacco machinery business anymore, but to many, it's thought of as a pension fund deficit with the business attached. Now, could you please discuss the workings of a defined pension scheme? And is there any prospect of MPAC being able to extricate itself from managing this scheme and through this, the payments, administration costs and the distractions?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question and important because of that history of the Molins organization with a very large employee base. You know, today there are still 4,000 participants in the MPAC pension scheme that we support. 3,000 of those are members, and 1,000 of them are deferred, so they're not yet of pensionable age, but they will become so at some point. And it is a mature scheme. You know, that pension scheme was closed to new entrants in 2012, so over a decade ago. But our responsibility is a final salary scheme, so the company's responsibility is to make sure that we support the schedule of contributions, so we continue to make sure that we can provide for those pension liabilities as people hit pensionable age and start drawing down the pension. And today, that schedule of contributions represents a £2 million a year obligation for MPAC to provide, and that goes through to the end of 2025. We'll renew, you know, beyond that, and as the scheme continues, so that we can continue to support the members. Since 2021, that was the last time that the scheme was valued. June 2021, the scheme was valued at 93% funded. So 93% of the liabilities that we expect to have to provide are, you know, were fully funded at that stage, and 7% weren't. And that's why the schedule of contributions is important. But actually, since that time, 2021, funding levels have improved, you know, very significantly. The next valuation isn't until June this year, June 2024. We have then a period to agree with the pension trustees what the new schedule of contributions will be, and work from that. So that process could take up to 18 months. That's the period that the pension regulator gives companies and trustees to agree, but probably will get done quicker than that. And you ask about, you know, what might happen to the scheme thereafter. Well, we're working really closely with trustees to get the data into good shape. It's a very large scheme with a lot of members. There's a lot of data to manage there, and to get the assets into a form that is as attractive as possible to a third party. That really would be a good thing for, I think, all parties concerned. And, you know, the good news is, and there is good news here, that for interest and inflation, so for interest rates and inflation levels, the scheme is effectively fully hedged today. So, you know, as liabilities rise and fall, the assets also rise and fall in the same ratio. You know, the reality is it's a very low risk scheme today. So, you know, I think the way you phrased it, Mark, was really insightful. You know, the business was thought of as a small business on the side of a large pension scheme, but actually it's a very low risk scheme, and we're increasingly close to, you know, a fully funded level.
Right, Adam. Well, when you were appointed a CEO, you said that you were not about 100-day plans or making strategic reviews or making radical changes, including changes of top management. Now, your predecessor oversaw a significant repositioning of the company, and I was just wondering if you'd care to comment on the job Tony Steeles did and the strength of the company you were able to inherit.
Yeah, I'd be very happy to. I mean, I think it's really important to say from the outset, I think Tony and the whole team did a really good job. If you're back to the period of kind of 2015, 2016, you know, the business was heading into the red, and actually did go into the red. There was a very significant leadership change at that point, not just Tony joining as chief exec, but significant change in the directors and the non-exec directors for the business, and a new chair as well. And that leadership team set about to exit the tobacco machinery industry and sell off everything related to cigarette manufacturing equipment and tobacco, and that was a really significant resizing of the group as well, and not an easy thing to do, but done very well and very quickly. So the team then set about designing a new strategy for the group, and, you know, that really was the strategy that I reviewed when I joined MPAC and thought very carefully about. And obviously, you know, there's a long tradition of CEOs, new CEOs coming into a business. At the point, I was a COO joining the group, but I had the same thoughts in my mind about reimagining the strategy and looking for a different direction for MPAC. And actually, my view very quickly after meeting customers, meeting our teams of people across the world and our suppliers, was a realization that actually the strategy that Tony and the board had set was a very good strategy. And the team had made good progress, you know, over the years that Tony led the business. So, you know, two acquisitions along the way, the Lambert business in the UK in 2019 and the Switchback business in the US in 2020, repositioning MPAC now as not a tobacco machinery business anymore, but an automation business with a footprint in packaging machinery and assembly automation. A really strong focus on improving the service revenues, which were pretty low at that point. The objective that the board set was to get to 30% of MPAC's revenue coming from services. And that's obviously really important for that kind of stability of repeat orders every day, every week, every month. And I think importantly, some great people. You know, when our customers choose to buy equipment from MPAC, what they're buying, what they're placing their trust in is the expertise of our people to be able to understand the issues in their organization and solve their problems. And, you know, I think the team have put together a really fantastic group of people across the world in MPAC today. And it was an absolute delight for me meeting them for the first time. And then the last thing, and probably not, you know, not to be sniffed at, is the customer base. An incredible blue chip customer base. You know, lots of people die for the list of customers that MPAC could very quickly point at from any given year. You know, whether it's with Nestle, with Gillette, with GSK, with AstraZeneca, and so on. The list goes on. These are, you know, really well respected blue chip customers with global presence who are, you know, always looking at what they're doing in their businesses and expanding and reimagining their production facilities. So a customer base to die for.
I was actually encouraged by that statement about the 100 day because I think I've seen every kind of new management there is. And one thing that puts fear into me is the bull in the china shop.
That's right.
When they come in. And sometimes things are needed to be done in a hurry, but a lot of the time, you know, just have a look round. And I think that sometimes it actually shows weakness. I think it's right just to, you know, take your time, have a look round, and don't do anything rash.
I think that's right. And you know, the kind of 100-day plan and strategic review often is code for we're going to downgrade, a forecast. We're going to announce a restructuring that will cost significant amounts of money and mop up cash in the near term. And, you know, that is a difficult thing for customers to hear. It's a difficult thing for employees to hear. And it's a difficult thing for investors to hear. And sometimes it is necessary, but it isn't always necessary. I've run turnaround businesses, you know, and it is important to act quickly in those cases. You know, MPAC is not in that place. You know, it's since those days of 2015, 2016, it's a growing business. You know, it's had its challenges along the way, but they've not been long-term strategic challenges. They've been short-term, you know, tactical things that had to get dealt with, and the team have done a good job of that. So, you know, my view today and my view on joining the business was it is a group with a good, sound strategy that just needs executing with pace now.
So given that place you're at, how would you characterise the main opportunities and challenges that MPAC faces today, Adam?
Well, I think the first thing is that the hook that got me into MPAC, the thing that got me really excited about the business as I was thinking about joining back in 2022 was the opportunity for growth. It is an enormous market, and perhaps surprising, you know, if you're not intimately involved in packaging machinery and automation equipment for production, the scale of the industry would be a surprise. You know, more than $50 billion worth of packaging machinery equipment is bought every single year by companies somewhere in the world. And it's a very stable industry. You know, we have good years and bad years for macroeconomics. You know, there are cost of living crises and, you know, the war in Ukraine and so on. And these things have an impact on the world. Of course they do. But in packaging machinery and automation, actually, we don't see a very significant impact on the scale of that market. It tends to grow in sort of low single digit percentages every single year. I guess in a year with cost of living crisis, there's probably, you know, a swing towards investment in more frozen pizza machines and perhaps fewer champagne bottling machines. But there is still that demand for new machines as people bring on new equipment to support growing populations and urbanization and rising GDP per capita and all those kind of fundamental factors that don't really change. So an enormous market and very stable. And that for me was a really interesting thing for a business that is still relatively small in that market. You know, 100 million turnover business that MPAC is today is a tiny, tiny market share. And so the biggest opportunity that the company faces is to focus on customers, to retain those blue chip customers who have, you know, been a mainstay of MPAC for many, many years, retain those customers and to win new customers and grow market share that way. So that's the first thing and really exciting, you know, coming into the company to realize that view from the outside is true. You know, there is that opportunity. There is a challenge, though. We're still a relatively small business, 100 million turnover, and our orders tend to come in lumps. You know, a 1, 2, 3, 4 million, 5 million pound order is not unusual for us. And that means that, you know, two or three orders one side of a year end or the other side of a year end can make a big difference to the numbers. And that lumpiness, you know, is a problem not just for investors to look at and understand, but also for the teams inside the business to deal with the lumps of, you know, starting work half a dozen projects at the same time is very different from smoothing those out over a period. So lumpiness is not an easy thing for the business to deal with. And it's had other examples of lumpiness. In 2022, there was a worldwide semiconductor shortage and issues with microchip availability affected every industry, affected yeah. automotive, affected us all. And MPAC was not immune to that either. So had issues in 2022 that added to that kind of lumpiness. Now, there is a way out of lumpiness. It's scale. You know, scale smooths lumps. If you imagine doubling the size of MPAC, not by doubling the size of each order, but by winning twice as many orders with twice as many different customers, that scale will smooth the lumps, but that takes time to do. So I think that's a challenge for us, but it, you know, there is a very sensible way out of it. And the third piece, and you know, for me, this was a really interesting thing to realize that MPAC had a track record in acquisition in 2019 and 2020. The competition in this space is very fragmented. You know, there are lots and lots of small businesses all over the world that do work in packaging machinery and automation. Sometimes they're focused on a particular type of automation or a specialist part of a production line, or maybe they haven't got the kind of geographical reach that MPAC has to be a global business, but they operate within one region. And there are lots of businesses of that type. There are some businesses of the scale that MPAC is, sort of 100 million up to 250, 500 million turnover. And there are some very large companies right up to the sort of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 billion turnover in our sector and everything in between. And of course, the very large companies have got the way they are by buying some of those smaller regional specialist businesses along the way. So yeah, fragmented competition, lots of opportunity for MPAC to grow in targeted ways through sensible acquisitions in the future, and a track record of doing it successfully in the past as well. So I thought that was a really interesting, you know, set of challenges to take on, and it's proving to be.
We'll come on and talk about how you are facing those challenges from a corporate perspective, but in a technical perspective, what are the most challenging things to pack, to put in a box? Because I think one thing that always amazes me is the speed at which all this happens and the technical precision and proficiency of managing these big packaging lines.
Yeah. Do you know, it's a great question. And the first that comes to mind is one of the first customers I went to visit, having joined MPAC. I went to visit Mars in the US to see the ice cream bar factory that Mars runs, the production facility that Mars runs in the US, providing not just Mars ice cream, but Twix and Snickers and what we call Galaxy is branded Dove in the States. And you know, what blew me away was the pace and the complexity of what's being done there. You know, putting Mars ice cream bars in a box very fast might not sound sexy and exciting to some, but when you see it happening at 12 bars a second, you know, you suddenly get a completely different appreciation of what's going on. And the timing between each bar as they're coming down the line at 12 a second towards the packaging machinery, you know, differences in the pitch between from one bar to another make an enormous difference in how the equipment has to manage that complexity. And it's not just the sort of positioning of the bar on the conveyor belt. The actual ice cream bar itself within the wrapper, you know, it could be at one end of the wrapper or the other end of the wrapper. These things move around a little bit. So, you know, real intricacies of how the engineering of a production line work, but happening at incredibly high speed. And then the MPAC equipment has to be designed to do some phenomenally difficult things. You know, if you imagine trying to stack ice cream bars on top of each other on a conveyor belt at pace and then push them into a carton, you know, they're pretty slippery things. You know, they move around within their wrapper. How do you stack these things at pace? That is not easy. And it's not just about the MPAC equipment. It's about the flow wrapping equipment upstream of us and the production equipment upstream of the flow wrapper and so on. So really interesting kind of collaboration and connectivity issues to work with other teams. And that's ice cream bars. You know, we could talk about handling wet contact lenses at speed to put them into the little blister packs. Putting tissues into tissue boxes at incredible rates, that's got its own challenges. Plasters, or you know, what the US would call band-aids. Cognac bottles, you know, you don't want to drop many of those and get those wrong. Beer cans, light switches, powder for asthma inhalers. It's a whole variety. And I think the thing that is really interesting for me as a physicist was realizing that what MPAC's very good at isn't just making machinery. It's taking disordered, disorganized product that's coming down the production line at very high speed and turning that into some kind of order, creating order from chaos, and doing that really, really fast so that we can then, you know, pack and distribute those products in the way that we do.
Another of my investments is Smurfit Kappa, and I'm playing the trend in the reduction of plastic packaging. So I'm wondering to what extent is the desire to reduce the amount of plastic and replace it, most commonly with paper, an accelerant for packaging machinery to be replaced or reconfigured ahead of perhaps its normal life expectancy?
Yeah, it's such an important trend today and one that MPAC can play a part in for sure. We launched recently, for example, a new cardboard tray former that can produce the sorts of cardboard trays that those biscuit selection boxes come with. You know, if you buy a biscuit selection box at Christmas or cookie selection box, and often they have a sort of plastic insert with all the biscuits stacked up inside them. Well, we've produced a machine that can produce a cardboard version of that, so it can be recycled with all the complexity of the manufacturing process and at the speed that cookie or biscuit companies need. So there are definitely opportunities to replace plastics with recyclable materials. We've seen an impact in that, for example, stick packs of coffee, these little sachets of coffee that you might see in a hotel room, you know, often were plasticized or plastic-based in the past, and a move towards paper versions of those sachets that has a really big impact on the recyclability of packaging materials. And it's hard to manage paper. You know, the process for sealing a stick pack of paper rather than a stick pack of plastic is roughly half the speed. So you've got to find a way of dealing with that in a production line, still hitting the economics that consumers expect. So some really interesting challenges. Coming into this industry, you know, I one of the thoughts in my head was how do I feel leading a business that is responsible for producing packaging machinery and automation equipment at a point where perhaps the biggest overwhelming trend that you can read about in the public press would be about reduction in packaging. You know, reduce packaging. And that's something I take very seriously in my personal life, and how do we bring that into our professional lives if our organizations are there to produce machinery for this? Well, the answer is that trend is a real force for change, and change creates opportunities for innovative companies, you know, for companies that can innovate and respond and lead on that change that creates new opportunities. And so for me, you know, thinking about what we can do as MPAC, it's a really exciting time, not just to do something for the environment, which we all care very passionately about, but also at the same time to create value for shareholders. You know, you can do both.
Okay. Thank you for that. In 2020, Langan conducted a webinar showcasing some of their packaging solutions. Now, this was targeted at customers and prospects, but I sat in on this. And I must say, I was blown away by the professionalism of the team live on camera. They were like seasoned TV professionals. Now, we're out of COVID restrictions. Do virtual demonstrations have a significant role to play, or is it necessary to see the machines in the flesh and meeting customers despite incurring these greater costs?
If I think back to that first trip to the US, one of the other customers I met in that same week was investing in a significant piece of automation for their facility. And I met the owner of the business and asked how he had come across MPAC and chosen this piece of equipment for his capital spend that year. And it was really interesting. He laughed and picked his phone out of his pocket and said, "Well, I'll show you. I was scrolling through YouTube and I happened to be looking for a piece of equipment to do a particular job. And I typed this into the search box and up popped a piece of equipment that looked exactly like what I wanted to buy. And I didn't know the company, and I scrolled to the bottom of the feed and found MPAC. And that was it. The next day we bought a piece of MPAC equipment." So the answer is absolutely yes. You know, it makes a really big difference. And I think the more that we can do, you know, to engage with the world without traveling, you know, that's a very good thing. However, and it's a big however, in our industry we have to go to factories. You know, the real insight into how to solve those complex technical problems happen at the factory. You know, looking up the line and thinking about what's happening upstream of the equipment that MPAC might one day provide downstream from us, looking at the materials and the packaging, looking at the way that operators on the line behave and the way that, you know, that people operate within that particular factory. All of those things can have a really big impact on the way that we need to support a particular project. And you know, we measure our sales team not just on, you know, how successful they are with customers, but on the time they spend with customers. It really is important to go to the factory and see the line. So I think inevitably the answer is that, yeah, we can't get away from that. That is a part of our industry.
It's interesting. You give us some really interesting insights there into what a customer journey is like or has been. You talked earlier also about your growth strategy and you want more sales from more customers. Can you just talk through what the sales strategy is? How are you going to achieve reducing the lumpiness by increasing the number of customers in the MPAC business?
Yes, no, I'm happy to. I mean, it starts by retaining our existing customers, and the service piece of our business is so important for that. You know, customers don't come back and buy new equipment if we don't perform well on the equipment we're providing today and support it through life. So that's really important. But the second piece is about broadening the customer base. And I actually think that's important for our existing customers too. You know, our existing customers want MPAC to retain those experts in our business, the engineers who really understand their equipment for many, many, many years. And the best way of retaining engineers is to keep them busy and excited and develop them on new, interesting projects all the time and highly utilized. And that is done well by broadening our customer base too. So it's good for us, it's good for our existing customers, and our new customers wouldn't choose us if they couldn't trust us with their business. You know, our equipment sits at the heart of their operations. We make and package the products that their businesses supply. You know, we're right at the center of what they're doing. So winning new customers is absolutely about being trusted with their business. We want to get to 40% of our revenue coming from new customers and 60% coming from existing retained customers from previous years. It comes from paying really close attention to customers and thinking about how to do that broadening in a sensible way. And I think probably the easiest way to is to give you an example. And I've got a customer in mind, but many of our customers are very private with their capital investments, and rightly so. This is a customer who we've worked with for many, many decades. They're a household name. They're a multinational with revenues in the many tens of billions. And they're organized in seven divisions. We historically have sold to two of them, and we sold £250,000 worth of equipment to those two divisions. So, you know, significant customer for MPAC over many, many years. And when I joined the group, I found it really interesting that one of those two divisions we hadn't sold to since 2015, 2016. And so I went to see them. And you know, I asked why did they stop? And there was a story, but actually, you know, what happened in the course of the conversation was that we all ended up laughing and realizing that there wasn't a particularly good reason that the business had stopped. And as a result of that initial conversation, through the course of the rest of 2023, we were involved in tenders and we were successful in re-winning work with one of those two divisions. So here we are at the end of 2023, now into 2024. Two of the seven divisions of that organization are customers of MPAC. The next question to our team was to ask, well, why is it only two? You know, what about three and four and five and six and seven? And a couple of things emerged from that conversation. It was that the first was that, as many large multinational blue chips do, there are framework agreements that are useful vehicles, commercial vehicles for doing business with any of their divisions. And we'd never set out to go and sign a framework agreement and agree contractual terms to do business with all seven. We'd just focus contract by contract, you know, time by time. So we made a very conscious decision to engage and get to a point where we could agree terms for a framework agreement. The second step, of course, is then moving on to customers that we don't have any dealings with today, but make up a large part of the market as well. So there's lots to go at, and I'm really excited about the progress the team have made. You know, that will be a theme, right, I think, for MPAC for many, many years to come.
So this way of selling is just a mindset change, or are you selling to a different point in the organization, therefore requiring a different skill set?
It's a mindset change and a focus. It is not an easy thing to do. I've described in very quick sequence, you know, how we went about winning another division of a seven division group. But the process of work to do that and the months of effort that go into it are significant because of that trust. You know, imagine you're the product lead about to launch a new product to the world in your fast moving consumer goods business, and your whole growth depends on that product succeeding. You know, when you select the company to automate the production and the packaging of it, you are making a really fundamental commitment of trust in that supplier. And that is a big thing for us to secure. That takes time and focus. It's not a new process for us. We know how to do it, and we've done it many, many times before, but it takes a considerable amount of leadership focus, and that's what we've done.
So one of the exciting new opportunities you've referred to more recently has been in battery packaging. Can you just talk a bit about that? Why do these batteries need packaging? And what are the specialist skills required in this industry?
Yeah, so this started for MPAC in the Lambert business that was acquired in 2019. And I think it's probably fair to say that at the time that MPAC acquired Lambert, it wasn't, you know, a key part of the strategy that batteries are part of that. But buried away in that Lambert business was a relationship with 24M Technologies in Boston in the States. 24M had developed a really interesting technology for making a semi-solid lithium-ion battery, different from the kind of traditional lithium-ion batteries that you can buy today, and offering a really significant change in the speed at which they can be manufactured, the energy consumption used in the process of manufacturing, and also therefore a reduction in cost as well. So pretty interesting. And they've proven it at lab scale, but to scale it up and prove it at the kind of gigafactory level that obviously we're all interested in for that deployment of technology, 24M started to work with a number of licensees, one of whom was Freya in Norway, a Norwegian business. And 24M introduced MPAC to Freya, and we set about working with Freya on really proving that we can scale up 24M's lab-based technology to the kind of production levels that are going to be required for it to be commercially viable in the future. And that's being done today, right now, in Norway, a little town called Mo i Rana, just about 50, 60 miles south of the Arctic Circle. There is a customer qualification plant, a CQP, being put together by Freya to prove at rate that this 24M technology really does scale up. And MPAC is providing the equipment for some of that line. Now, interestingly, you know, it's actually not the packaging equipment at the end of the line. It's fundamentally assembling the cell itself. So when you make a lithium-ion cell, what you do is you take a roll of electrode for the cathode electrode and a roll of electrode for the anode, and you coat it in some way with a kind of active electrolyte. And they're either rolled and put into a cylinder if they're a cylindrical cell, or they're stacked and turned into a little pouch cell if it's a prismatic cell. And you know, Freya's technology is a prismatic. The 24M process is a prismatic cell. And our equipment is fundamentally running that process. So forming the electrodes, coating them, cutting them, stacking them, welding them, and at the end of the MPAC equipment out pops a cell ready to be combined with other cells into a battery pack and charged and discharged for the first time. So it's really fundamental. And you know, why on earth does MPAC have the skills to do that? Well, it turns out the process for handling that kind of web of material and the process that go along with optical inspection and laser cutting and welding and so on aren't very different from the processes that you use for making a nappy, you know, a diaper, or an ostomy bag, or many of the other kind of webs that the Lambert business has handled over many, many years. So the team really understood how to do this, but we're obviously not experts in batteries. It is really hard. You know, I think if you were to speak to the Freya chief exec or to 24M, they would say the same thing. You know, new technology is really hard. Scaling it up is really hard. And we're working really collaboratively to solve those problems every single day in Norway. It's easier right now because it's just a few miles south of the Arctic Circle. It's not the time to spend lots of time outdoors. So the team are inside working around the clock on this stuff. And, you know, we're an automation business. We're not experts in the battery technology itself. What we're experts in is automating other people's processes. And 24M and Freya are experts in their process. So the collaboration is working really, really well. This is something that could not be done manually at all at the pace and scale and quality that's required. You know, you could never design a manual process for this and produce cells in this way. So yeah, it's a really interesting piece where the product that's being made goes hand in hand with the machinery for making it.
So MPAC of larger and smaller competitors, and an oft-used strap line for a business is big enough to cope, small enough to occur. Now, obviously, MCAP are looking to grow, but is it currently at what you would call a Goldilocks size?
Yeah, so there is something absolutely wonderfully special about the way MPAC runs today. You know, the values and the culture of the business absolutely lives up to that mantra, you know, big enough to cape, small enough to care. I think my experience is that you can still do that at a larger scale. it can be done. It's really important to protect that culture that already exists within the business as we scale. I think it'd be much harder if we didn't have that culture today, you know, to create it from scratch in the future. I think that would be a really, really difficult thing to do, and, you know, perhaps still possible, but not easy. Protecting a culture that already exists is a bit easier as long as we're really clear about what it is that makes us special today. And I think probably the other piece here is that the structure of an organization has to change as you grow. You know, the structure that's right for us at 100 million isn't going to be right for us at a billion turnover. Equally well, you know, transitioning at the right moments is important, and not rushing to change the structure for the sake of it now, you know, and getting the right structure for the right scale. So I absolutely think it can be done.
So on the subject of scaling, you talked about the opportunity for acquisitions. How do you go about looking, finding your acquisitions, and what are the key criteria you're going to be looking for?
For us, it's absolutely about technology. So we're really good at the kind of assembly processes that we talked about earlier. We're really good at secondary packaging, that's putting things into cartons, cardboard cartons at very high speed. And we're pretty good at end of line as well, which is putting things into kind of cardboard corrugated cases or trays and so on, or on stacking them onto pallets for distribution. But there are gaps. We very rarely do a complete production flow line for our customers. There are gaps upstream and downstream of our equipment, and there are some gaps in particular types of packaging machinery in secondary and end of line as well. So filling those gaps is really important, because if I look ahead to organizations that we compete with that are 2 or 3 or 10 times the scale of MPAC, none of those have those gaps in the equipment that they're able to offer to their customers. They can offer a complete flow line. So at some point in our journey, in our future, we're going to need to plug those gaps. Now, some of that can be done through research and development and new product introduction, but some of it would be better done through acquisition. And for me, the key to this is we absolutely must retain our existing customers by continuing to be trusted. And the last thing we want to do is to introduce a new risk for a customer by developing a product that is outside of our existing expertise and then failing in deploying it for them on a project. So that is the key decision point. It's probably also important, therefore, to say it's not about geography or market sector for us. We operate in food and beverage and healthcare and clean energy. Those markets are very significant. We don't need to go into new markets to grow our business. We don't need to go into new geographies. Most of our businesses today operate in North America and Western Europe. You know, we have service teams all over the world, but our operating facilities are in those geographies. So we're pretty clear about the kinds of things that we want to go and do. What we can't be clear about, for good reason, is the timing. You know, we're not in control of when those particular kinds of businesses come to market.
The last dividend was in 2016, Adam. Now, in 2019, a 1.5 pence dividend was announced, but in a subsequent trading update and the unknowns, understandably, surrounding COVID-19, this was cancelled. Now, since then, there's been no mention of returning to dividend payments. Can you foresee any prospective dividends returning, and how important do you think dividends are to attracting investors? Are some investors screen stocks to include a dividend?
It comes up quite a bit, actually, when we talk to investors, and I think it's right that it comes to the board for consideration regularly. Today, we have the same view that we had a year ago when I joined the business. We create long-term shareholder value best by investing the cash we generate into growth, and growing our business is the best way of delivering that kind of long-term value. So that's going to continue to be our focus, now and for the near term. But that question will continue to come up, and we will continue to look at it every single time, because it's a fair question.
Yeah. Total return I look at.
Covering this area, what's your sort of overall view of capital allocation? To invest in your business, you've got to, which presumably a lot of that is people, you've got to try and maybe think about paying people like Mark a bit of a dividend every now and again to keep him interested. And you got to think about, and of course we know it's all very unpredictable, whether there might be acquisitions around the corner that we can expect to have to allocate capital to. So can you just sort of sum up your approach to thinking about how you allocate capital in this business?
Yeah. I think the first priority for us is our people. You know, that it is our people that our customers are committing to when they place an order with us, and recruiting, training, developing our people is probably the biggest single focus for us, and probably highlights that we're not a very capital intensive business. Therefore, you know, we don't have to spend vast amounts of capital on new machinery in our organization to grow. Product development is important to us. We spend money every year on innovation, developing new products to bring to market and improving the products that we already provide. So, you know, that is important to us, but again, it's not a significant amount of capital, you know, compared with some other organizations.
And is that developed as your own IP, or are you constantly developing IP that becomes your customer's IP?
A bit of both. So if we're investing our own capital, it is our IP, but on each project that we work on for a customer, there are innovations on those projects that depending on the contract, the customer may own, or we may have the rights to use. So it does vary, but we develop both on project and off project. But it's not a huge amount of capital. It's not like investing in Freya making the decision on a new gigafactory with their customers, for example, those significant steps. We do invest in facilities. We're investing in the Tadcaster facility in the UK right now to refurbish and bring that facility up to a really good standard for the future. But again, even that isn't a significant expenditure. And you're right to bring up acquisitions, but we treat them on a case-by-case basis. You know, we're not the sort of organization that is looking at building a war chest of capital to go and you know, then decide how to divvy up and what to buy. We deal with each acquisition, you know, case by case as they arise, and therefore exceptional to the normal process.
So you're investing in your people, that's critical. You're an engineering-led business. Where do you get your skilled people from, and is this a bottleneck to your growth plans?
Yeah, when I joined the business, that was one of the sort of real concerns I had, was I could see a path to grow the group, but could we find enough people quickly enough to keep pace with that growth? And you know, the sort of delicious irony of this is that, you know, we're an automation business. You know, when the headlines say that there are labor shortages and there's therefore an increased need for automation, you know, that's a good thing for MPAC, but it also is a challenge. And dealing with that labor shortage for engineers is important. And how are we doing it? Well, we have apprentice programs, bringing people in, you know, through the apprentice programs, and then retaining them in the business as they develop. We're always looking for software engineers and field service engineers, and we've had some considerable success in finding them. We more than doubled the field service engineering team in the US, for example, last year, in a single year, and we brought some fantastic people into the business in that process. So it's really, really exciting. And you know, sat here today, I'm much more confident in MPAC's ability to continue to attract great people to the business than I might have been, you know, joining the business and wondering about it from the outside.
Okay, thank you. And in the second half update, your latest update, you reported on substantially better cash flow performance in the business. And I suspect it's related to the unwinding of the component shortages that you and everybody else suffered from in 2022. Given events going on in the world, is there a risk of a reversal of that episode? And is there also a requirement now in a business like yours for a permanently higher level of working capital in the business?
So 2023 was definitely affected by supply chain shortages. You're right in the way you've expressed that. And it was really a tale of two halves. So in 2022, the business was impacted by the shortages directly, and you couldn't complete projects that had been started. By the time I joined the business, the team had done a fantastic job of addressing that issue. They did it by stocking parts ahead of customer orders, redesigning components and sub-assemblies with our suppliers to use different kinds of chips and mitigate the problem that way, and also to find alternative suppliers and alternative products, you know, where customers could accept a change. And all of those changes meant that by the end of 2022, we'd resolved those issues. You know, suppliers were delivering on time every single time. And the first half of 2023, all that remained was to clear this kind of backlog of impacted projects, which we did. And that was a large part of the reason that the second half of 2023 was significantly improved. We cleared through that backlog. the CQP facility for Freya had moved from the installation into the commissioning phase, and that affected performance in the second half as well. And we'd fundamentally started that kind of growth curve we talked about earlier. So all of those things combined meant we had a much better second half in 2023 in a way that I would expect that to continue into 2024. But there is a long-term impact still on our business of these chip availability issues, which is the lead time. Lead times are significantly longer today than they were in the past. And for some of these components, they can be, you know, well over a year. There's a particular component we're looking at earlier this week that is on an 80-week lead time for us. And, you know, that's more than twice the length of a typical project. So, you know, there is still a lead time impact here. And while lead times are long, our project lead times will be long, and working capital will be high. Bringing lead time back down is a much more challenging project, and you know, we've started work on that already. You'd be not unsurprised to hear. It will continue to see a reduction in working capital, but perhaps at a lower pace than we saw in 2023 with this really significant unwind. So I think the conclusion really is there are significant opportunities still for working capital to unwind going forwards, but those lead time improvements will take longer to deliver than the unwind that we saw in 2023. So more to do and lots of opportunity to improve cash.
This is your first stint running a publicly listed company. You're clearly very experienced and doing some tough management roles in engineering companies previously. There's been a lot of pessimism around those of us who follow the listed PLC arena, particularly in the small cap space, due to liquidity issues and all kinds of issues. I think that some think it's structural, others think it's just a result of the cyclicality of the world we live in. Have you found being running a PLC? What are the new challenges? How have you found it?
I think if I think about that piece around the small cap PLC space, I'm an investor in our business as well, and I think about those pessimisms as being an opportunity, really. Small cap has a significant opportunity for upside right now. You know, I think about impact and how we're positioned as an investor in our business. I look at the EV to EBITDA multiples, and you know, I look at other similar packaging machinery businesses that are public listed and data is available for, or acquisitions that have happened in our sector and the multiples that those trades have been done at, and I look at where MPAC is in relation to those benchmarks, and I have lots of reasons to be really positive about the things that we can do with the group. So, you know, as an investor, I have that view. As chief exec, my job is really, really clear. You know, I spend much more of my time thinking about how to run the business really well and what we need to do to you know, grow our business. Shareholders will decide the value of the share price, you know, not me. And I'll leave that to them.
Okay, good answer. Can you then just give us the long-term vision bit as part of the sort of, I mean, coming to the end here? What's the scale of your ambition in this company? You've come from much bigger businesses. This is your gig now. You know, what's your vision thing? I'm not asking for next quarter's numbers or next year's numbers, but where's MPAC going to be in 10 years' time? What kind of geographical footprint will it have? Just share us your thoughts of where you think you can take this business.
The long-term plan that we've agreed with the board is deliver 10% return on sales and 10% revenue growth every year. That's where we're heading in the long run. I think in the near term, we've actually got an opportunity to go faster than that on the bottom line and to deliver faster profit growth. But you know, when I look at the organizations that we compete with every day, you know, many of them are up to $1 billion or larger in their revenue. And I see no reason that we couldn't one day be competing alongside those organizations, you know, head to head at more than $1 billion revenue. I'm not going to put a timescale on it, but that's where we're going. And what do we have to do to get there? Well, we've got to stay absolutely laser focused on our customers. You know, they have to keep choosing to work with us every time they invest in a new project. We've got to keep building teams. You know, this business is founded on great people, phenomenal expertise, and some really incredible know-how. And that's what our customers buy when they buy into MPAC. And we've got to keep innovating. You know, that sense of urgency to go out and do something really important every single day. And if we do those things, I am very confident in the long-term future of the group and that scale that we can achieve.
Thank you. Mark, what do you reckon? You a happy shareholder?
Yes. Well, I've been involved since 2013. So what we've been looking at the business now and what Adam's had to say, I can't see any reason why I'm not going to follow on the journey. So, you know, the share price can be all over the place, can't it? You know, where's it going to be in 12 months' time? No idea. In 10 years' time, I think we should be. I think we've got a good future ahead of us here.
Does sound that way.
Yeah.
Adam, thank you so much for your time today. We've had a great chat. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Time's flown by. Good luck with the future. And I look forward to following your progress with great interest. Thank you.
Jeremy, Mark, thank you very much.
Brought to you by Progressive Equity.